Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Representative Kristen Jacobs has taken a unique approach to reducing sea level rise and mitigating the effects of climate change. She's one of the pioneers behind the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Compact, an agreement between Monroe, Broward, Miami-Dade, and Palm Beach counties, this to have the same data standards for sea level rise projections and follow guidelines that reduce our carbon footprint. Jacobs is currently running for re-election in District 96, which covers a large swath of Broward County, including Parkland. She helped in the passage of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Act and has made school safety a top campaign priority. Now, earlier we spoke with Democratic challenger Saima Farooqui, who, if elected, would become the first Muslim in Florida's state house. Now, just a reminder, next Monday is the deadline for you to register to vote in this year's primaries. Now, we started our conversation with Representative Jacobs by asking why she's running for this office.
Because I love what I'm doing. It's such an honor to be there. I know that sounds kind of corny, but when I first ran for the House, I wasn't sure where I was going to land or what I would be able to contribute because it's so partisan and it's so top-down driven. And in my freshman year, I really struggled with that, the first year in particular. But by the second and then by the third session, I started to figure out how to navigate the system. I reached out for mentors on both sides of the aisle and in both chambers. And in so doing, I learned a lot about how to move bills. And so my bills moved in this last year. It was really exciting to see them get voted on and pass on the floor and see the governor sign them. There's a lot more work that I'd love to do. And hopefully I get this next year, this next session, and then the one after that. And then I don't know. They say we make plans and God laughs. So I have no idea what's beyond this. But I know the thing in front of me, the thing I'm most passionate and want to do, is go back to the House and do good things for Broward.
And what's one bill in particular that you're most proud of that did pass?
Well, most recently, it was the House Bill 53, which set up a conservation zone that went from the Dry Tortugas all the way to St. Lucie Inlet across four counties and set up a conservation area that's similar to the National Marine Sanctuary of the Keys and just basically extended it north. The reason for this bill, I introduced it last year as well, and it didn't pass last year. But the second part of it, which was the $1 million for funding and monitoring, did pass last year and was also included into DEP's budget going forward this year. So I don't have to keep doing a member project to continue the funding. So the bill basically takes a look at our coral reef system, which is in decline. We've lost 21 of 35 species in just over 2 years, and we don't know why they're dying. One of them was 330 years old, and before the universities could get out there and take samples so they could take it back to their labs and actually grow those corals and try to implant or plant them back later, it died that quickly.
What do you see as the more urgent issues for your district?
Sea level rise right now is a huge issue and has been. It's something I've worked on for almost all of my career. And it's a real challenge for not just people think of sea level rise as an issue for the coast, but I can show you photographs of flooding 35 miles inland in Palm Beach County. We know what happened in Jacksonville and throughout the state with Hurricane Irma. And I mean, we've got almost a billion claims that went in from one storm. So we know that we're not necessarily going to be getting more storms, but the ones that we have will come in greater severity. Everything from our potable water to our infrastructure is at risk. And for those governments that wake up and start addressing the issue, they are going to have that advantage of those that have it. And so some of that work, a lot of that work needs to happen on the state side. It's not. I jokingly say that the real grown-ups in the room are cities and counties that are tackling this issue out of a pragmatic sense of what needs to get done and looking long enough into the future to set their dollars and their budgets aside to address it. And the state is varying steps, fits, and starts of what they're doing.
All right. Let's jump into that as one of the big topics. And, of course, is the issue of climate change, sea level rise. Explain to us how the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Compact got started. This is a big one for you.
It is. It's my baby. It started with a visit to Washington. There were a variety of people from county commissioners back when I was a county commissioner. And we were visiting from all over the country, and they grouped us by our region. So I was moving through congressional offices with county commissioners from Miami-Dade, Monroe, and Palm Beach. And at the end of the day, we could each tell each other stories about what was happening with climate change in our communities and in our counties. And I thought, you know, we ought to do this for real. Couldn't we come together and do something formally? So it took a whole year to get the counties to pass the compact. There were points where I didn't think it was going to happen. One county changes the words and you have to re-agenda it and re-adopt it. And poor Monroe County had to do that 3 times. Palm Beach had to adopt it twice because the 2 big ones in the room, Broward and Miami-Dade, kept making changes. But ultimately we passed it. It's now been 10 years. And as a result of this compact, the 4 counties are moving forward as a region. We started with 110 specific recommendations that were then turned into the Regional Climate Action Plan, which has just recently been readopted, understanding that there are new elected officials that weren't here when the compact first started. And it's always kind of scary to re-agenda something, but you wanted to make sure that everyone's still in. And so it passed unanimously across the 4 counties.
How does that compact function exactly? I mean, these are not laws. These are just... Mm-mm. Ideas that counties and cities should kind of all be on the same page with, right?
That's what's so beautiful about it, is it isn't law. No one was forced to do anything. And in my opinion, when you come together voluntarily out of a sense of shared interest and concern about the same challenge, and you start to look at what you can do and you do it together, that will last much, much longer than when you make it as a mandate. So the 4 counties adopted all of the same recommendations, but as far as implementing it, and over 80% of the regional action plan has been put into implementation. So it's not just a book of words, it's actually in place.
And so these are just, again, it's not a law, it's not anything that's required. So are there teeth, though? Does it have teeth to really enforce anything or to bring on change?
It does, because the counties individually and the cities under them, there's 109 cities, took the recommendations and implemented them as their budgets and their own political leadership wanted to see fit. So you have, for example, the region agreed on a unified sea level projection that took a year just to develop that, to bring all of the players, including FEDA and state, together. And then we all started planning around that horizon. So we're doing it each in our own way, but we're doing it within the confines of this plan. It doesn't mean that you have to take every piece of that plan. And there's no punishment if you don't do it. The best thing is that over 10 years, everyone, every city and county has been moving in the same direction.
Help us understand what's going on in Tallahassee. So what we've seen over the last few years is that there is a lot of pushback on the idea of climate change. There were, you know, stories that the governor doesn't even want to say the word. Granted, he has now started saying the word in his campaign for U.S. Senate. But what's going on in Tallahassee? How do they see this issue any differently than what we're going through and what we think down here?
It's interesting that the state is more removed from it than the cities and the counties are. And I think probably that has a lot to do with the fact that legislators come from all over the state. They come from various backgrounds where they may not have the expertise, and they're only there during session or special sessions, which can, in my first year, for example, session went for 16 months. I was away from home. But generally, you're not there that long. And so what's happening in Tallahassee is, we hear this all the time, the governor won't say climate change. But the truth is, he has passed during his time as a governor 4 bills that were related to climate change. One of them was my bill. And this bill took a kind of a page out of where we all started as counties in our compact, which was, first get your own backyard in order. Let's look and see what the state agencies are doing. They're not talking to one another. They're all kind of isolated in their silos. So the bill required them to come together at least 4 times a year, which they actually now do more often than the mandated 4 times, but to come up and come out of their silos and plan together so the agencies are talking to one another. So that's been incredibly helpful. The governor signed that bill, and ironically, he signed that bill on climate change the same day that President Trump walked away from the Paris Accord. So we often say we can't say climate change in the state. The Secretary Ballenstein, who's the head of DEP, the Department of Environmental Protection, he has faced that agency from inward to kind of outward looking and are giving resources for this issue.
Do you get the sense that other lawmakers in the state, regardless of party, that they're on board with the issue and that this is a problem, not just for South Florida, this is a problem for the entire state, the country? Do you think they get it?
I think there are those that do, and there are some that don't. Luckily, I am on a series of committees as ranking member where these bills, anything that deals with the environment, water, agriculture, comes in. I'm on the first committee, and I'm on the second and the third committee until that bill gets to the floor. So I'm blessed to be in that role. I'm really thankful the speaker put me there, and hopeful that that's right where I end up again, to be able to influence those bills. And as you work through those committees, you see all of the folks I serve with in that path. They are engaged in this issue. They are paying attention.
You're listening to a previous conversation we had with Democratic Representative Kristen Jacobs, who represents Florida's District 96. That district includes Parkland, Coral Springs, Coconut Creek, and Margate. Jacobs is running against Saima Faruqi of Coconut Creek. Jacobs also runs the nonprofit Resiliency Florida and has made climate change, school safety, and agriculture among her priorities in the legislature. Let's return to that conversation. Let's move to the issue of school safety, gun laws. District encompasses Parkland, of course, the site of the deadly shooting back in February. Talk about the conversations that you had with parents and teachers after that tragedy.
You know, it was such an emotional time that it's left its mark on so many people. The legislature was not exempt from that. And so we did pass the gun safety bill. It's the first gun control bill that's been passed in this state in 20 years. It was, at the end of the day, it was a bipartisan effort. There were people on either side of that issue that felt very strongly that their party needed to control their vote. And there were a whole bunch of us that knew you could not come home with nothing. We had to be able to come out of this tragedy with something good. The 17 families who lost their children all were unified in asking for that bill to pass. And so
the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Act.
Yes, okay. Exactly. And so it's made changes, but we need a lot more time to understand exactly, you know, how all these dollars are going to be spent.
And some of your Democratic counterparts boycotted the legislation. They didn't think it went far enough. But you, some other Democrats, felt this is better than nothing? I mean, why did you go for it?
I think it's essential that we don't take a my way or the highway approach. If we had asked for everything on one side of the aisle, what all Democrats wanted, it would never have moved through the House. It's interesting when you consider there's 120 members of the House and only 41 of them are Democrats. So we can stomp our feet and yell and scream all we want, but nothing's moving without the blessing of leadership. So, and if you look across this country, you see over and over that people have forgotten how to govern. They've gotten so locked into their one position that they will not budge. And I felt, and I know a lot of my colleagues felt, this issue is too important to play that game. We simply must be able to come home with something.
It was, people will say that gun legislation wasn't even on the radar until the Parkland shooting. And then we saw a governor go against the NRA, which the NRA is now suing because of this law. Do you think that carries over into the next session? There'll be another discussion about school safety and guns? Or really, was it just because of the pressure that you had from the students and families who have been shoving this in people's faces?
I do believe we're going to have some sort of discussion about the bill and going forward. We put $400 million towards solving some of the problems. To the degree to which leadership feels that those dollars are well spent and some that want to see it spent in another direction, I think there is going to be some conversation. I don't know whether a bill will be introduced to take it to the next step. I do think it was kind of a once-in-a-lifetime bill that passed. The circumstances were just right. The activism, the families, the kids, oh my goodness, the kids, they were a huge factor in moving it forward. I don't think that this issue is going away. The students aren't going to let it go away. All of us that were affected aren't going to let it go away.
Let me move over to another topic. Lots to cover here. You were formerly the Democratic ranking member of the Agriculture and Natural Resources Subcommittee. The algae blooms have already devastating the state on both coasts and consistently a problem year to year. What's been wrong in our approach? I know that the Army Corps of Engineers plays a big role in this, but what's wrong in our approach here? How do we solve this problem?
Septic tanks. If you look at DEP and the Department of Health, DEP on the Indian River Lagoon has estimated there's about 400,000 septic tanks, 50% of which are over 30 years old. They're basically flushing toilets straight into the water bodies. The storm water is running off straight untreated into the water bodies. 70% of the pollution in those areas is coming from us. We don't want to look at it that way, though. We don't want to look at our pockets, the cost to go from septic to sewer. The problems that happen when excess water falls and runs through the lake and comes out the backside. There's a big argument to send it south. We can't continue to send too much water south because we'll drown out the ecosystem of the Everglades. What we need to do is finish the projects in the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, which has been in place for well over 20 years, and most of that plan has never been implemented. The Tamiami Trail has 1 mile of it constructed that is to raise it up so the water can flow. Another mile is under construction now, but there's a total of 10 miles that have still, you know, that's sitting there and unfunded. There are lots of other projects in the southern part of the SERP plan that are also not funded. So I think sometimes people want to point the finger to one agricultural industry and say it's them. That's the problem. We need to solve that.
Well, whether it's one agricultural industry or they just want to say it's ag. Ag plays a big part. But, I mean, what about that argument?
You know, so if you think about when your septic tank gets pumped out, where does that go? Most people think it goes to a wastewater treatment plant and gets treated somehow. But up there, the septic tanks, they get pumped out, they get what's called dewatered, they pull some of the water out, and then it is spread over agriculture as fertilizer. These are processes that need to stop. Ag is a part of the problem, but more importantly, we are a part of the problem. It is a broad problem that needs to be addressed. If you consider how all of the inputs that are coming from the Orlando or central part of the state, the water that's rolling into the lake is coming in at about 400 parts per billion phosphorus. It's coming out of the lake across different farms because they're taxed and because they have mandatory best management practices. On the south side of the lake, you will see that those waters are being tested at anywhere from 8 and 10 and 12 parts per billion. What's coming in is coming in from ag that has they don't have mandatory best management practices. It's voluntary. So I think there's a lot of ways in which some of the bills we've passed are chipping away at it. I resist and actually I get frustrated by this issue being made into a partisan one. This is not about partisan politics. This is about if you really love our state, and I do, you know that there are broader problems and broader solutions out there than just the one.
Based on reporting by the Miami Herald and the nonprofit VoteSmart, you've received financial contributions from companies in ag. Can you confirm that you have independence from these industries that are supporting your campaign?
Oh, absolutely. I've had contributions from all kinds of industries. Ag is a part of my contributions, but if you add up all of the contributions to my campaign, they're a very small amount. At the end of the day, unless the public wants to fund campaigns, and they don't, we have to raise money. That's a part of the process. It's a reality of running for office. And so, you know, I suppose you could go around saying, well, I won't take money from this one or I won't take money from that one. They're not buying anything with their money. That's part of the process, the political process.
All right. Looking at this upcoming election, there is a talk of a blue wave. But let's say that the House and Senate stay in Republican control. Let's say you have a Republican governor. Now, you did talk a little bit about reaching out to the other side for mentorship even. But how do you get things done when you have that sort of control by one party.
I've managed to get things done because I work across the aisle. If you think that standing at a podium and throwing political bombs and then go to the chair of a committee and ask him to hear your bill or ask the speaker to let your bill move forward, that's probably not going to work out too well for you. So it's an issue of respect for me. If you sit down with someone and you understand and you talk to them about what their issues are, you're not necessarily going to change your point of view, but you'll better understand theirs, that you understand that moving legislation forward isn't something you do by yourself. You can go yell and stomp your foot all you want, but unless you figured out how to work with one another, how to be respectful and civil, you're just simply not going to move anything forward. And honestly, to go to Tallahassee and be away from my family and my community as much as I have and go up there and not be able to accomplish anything but be partisan, be a partisan hack, I find that very unacceptable. I think we must figure out how to get along, how to govern. It's what people want from us. They don't want us to go up there and just rattle our partisan saber. They expect us to come home with something getting done.
That goes to something else that's interesting, is that you have to spend a certain amount of time in Tallahassee, but how do you balance the two? And, you know, what do you say to folks who say, you're not here enough? You're not in your district enough. I mean, where's the balance?
You know, I find that an interesting comment because I am a state legislator. I'm not a county or city legislator. I also am a Democrat from Broward County. If I want to get things done, I have to understand it's not just working with leadership and committee chairs and so forth. It's the agencies themselves. Remember, agency heads are appointed by the governor. And given that you have Republican control right now, the agency heads don't listen to me. They listen to their legislators. To their leadership, unless, of course, you go and spend time with them, which is what I have done. I've spent time going to other parts of the state to meet my fellow legislators where they are. I have spent time with the different agencies, transportation and environmental protection are my chief ones. But there are other issues that are going on. If you think that you're going to be able to be a state legislator and stay home to do it, then you probably shouldn't be running for the state legislature. You're going to spend, I have spent a lot of time up there. It's a balancing act because it's 7 hours to drive up there. There's no quick way to fly either. And so it is a real sacrifice, the amount of time that you do spend away from your family and your kids and friends. But I think it comes with the territory. You just know if you're running for the Florida House, you're going to be away from home. And it's just the way it works.
We did get some questions from some of our listeners. Here's one in particular that they wanted to know what particular legislation you've worked on, or in what ways have you tried to fight the issue of discrimination in protecting minority groups like the LGBTQ community?
You know, when I look at a lot of the issues that we've taken on, we haven't had bills that have come through that have been advanced in that area. And because I sit in sort of a little silo of environment from the beginning, I'm ranking member on two of my four committees, and none of those are the issues that are dealing with minority issues. So I haven't really had much experience in that arena, as you won't. And as you get into the House, you get siloed into these different categories of committee, and that's where you spend your time.
So I'll finish with this. For you, what do you see as the most important thing for you if you get reelected? What's that pressing issue that you really want to push most for?
The issue I think facing our state right now is the issue of water. Whether you're losing your wells to saltwater intrusion, or you have issues of flooding, or you have issues associated with rising insurance costs because of flooding and the way the markets look at our state and risk-based pricing, all of that is about to change. Water is a huge issue for our state, and I think it's really important that a person who knows these issues is up there pushing for change, and that's what I'll be doing.
And again, that was Democratic Representative Kristen Jacobs of Florida's 96th District. An editorial note, we incorrectly stated in our conversation with Saima Faruqi, her opponent, that Pompano Beach is part of District 96. It is part of District 93. So our apologies on that. A reminder that this Monday is the deadline to register to vote in the upcoming primaries. Florida's a unique state. Remember, you have to be part of one of the parties if you want to vote in a primary election.